You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. On today's episode, we mix supernatural thrillers, ghostly haunts, and a mutual love of Bigfoot with writer and producer Rowena Amos. Rowena's short film, Strange Waters, is a fabulous short supernatural thriller that has been wowing film festival audiences all year. Filmed on a haunted sea fort off the coast of Portsmouth, the film follows five people unfortunately trapped somewhere they wish they weren't. Rowena also takes us to some of the most notable haunted locations on the Isle of Wight, as well as discussing her Bigfoot obsession. A big thank you to Rowena, and make sure you check the link in the show notes to see Strange Waters 2. As always, before that, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at Patreon, patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters, or click on the link in the show notes as usual. $4 a month gets you ad-free episodes, guaranteed early releases, and bonus content, as well as much more. Mysteries and Monsters is also across all social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to our channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for episodes, news, and Mysteries and Monsters merchandise. A big thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange network. Now prepare for some supernatural tension, ghostly haunts from the South Coast, and more in the company of Rowena Amos. On today's episode, I am delighted to welcome writer and producer Rowena Amos. Her debut short film, Strange Waters, directed by Andy MacLeod, has been garnering kind words and accolades with awards galore. And with a deep passion and interest in the paranormal, Rowena uses her home base on the Isle of Wight as an inspiration for her work. Rowena, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters.
Thank you very much. I'm very privileged. That's an amazing introduction. Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome. As I was saying before we started the interview, thank you for scaring me with your latest film, Strange Waters.
No, you're welcome. I'm glad you were scared slightly by it. It's one of those things, you know, when we were making it, I was thinking, I don't think we intentioned it. We wanted it to be kind of sort of strange. And then the sort of response from people was like, oh, it's actually quite scary. You know, I think maybe we made it a bit scarier than we intended. But yeah.
When I speak with people, Rowena, from a variety of pursuits and passions and careers, I'm always intrigued by people like ourselves who clearly have had a deep love for a specific genre of the arts. And I know that as a younger person, you were a very keen writer, primarily in comedy. And I've always found the connection between comedy and the paranormal quite well linked. Now, maybe that's just my personal interpretation of it all. But for you, I would imagine you're one of those people that you clearly had a love for both of these subjects from a very early age.
Yeah, I think I did. I sort of like kind of black comedy, really. And I think that kind of naturally lends itself to sort of the dark and the strange and the sort of paranormal, I guess. And so a lot of the things I write have some sort of humor in it. And I think also if you're writing something that's quite dark, you need that sort of contrast. You know, you need sometimes a bit of sort of comic element in it so that it doesn't get too dark, really, or too heavy for a film. So, but yeah, I mean, I've always been fascinated with the sort of paranormal or any strange subject matter. So it's, and I think as I've got older, my writing, I feel more comfortable writing about that now. And I've been writing quite a bit for the last few years, and there's quite a big audience for it, which is great. So I'm just kind of sticking with my niche, I think, at the moment. And we're going for the sort of dark and weird, which this film is slightly. So it's funny. It's been put, I would kind of say it's a sort of a supernatural kind of thriller, I guess, but it's been put into the horror for quite a lot of the categories. I don't really see it too much as a kind of horror in a, it's more of a Blair Witch, I suppose, than the kind of driller killer kind of thing. but you know, it's interesting how people perceive what you do.
Are you one of those people, Rowena, that had a paranormal experience as a young person, or was it just that you were quite excited? Because, you know, as I've mentioned on my show previously, I had the, some would say, the good fortune or the misfortune to grow up in a haunted house and had a grandmother who did tarot readings to the great and good in the local area and was friends with Doris Stokes.
Oh, wow.
Despite the fact I had no idea who Doris Stokes was as a six-year-old. So, or was it just like many children and teenagers, we develop a thirst for the scary? And I know you're a big Stephen King fan.
I am, yes, I am. No, I was brought up in a haunted house. My parents had this a really sort of big, run-down, crumbly old house in the middle of nowhere, which was actually, I discovered later, built on a ley line, which was quite interesting. The house was just, there was so much activity in the house that I think somehow you had to kind of sort of normalize it. You know, there'd be stuff that'd be going on all the time. And my mum and dad were quite open to it, and they used to see things and people. There was a numerous ghosts there. I think as a child, it was quite weird because you had to think it's a ghost. It's not somebody breaking in. You know, you had to, especially sort of being in the middle of nowhere. So I was kind of brought up with it in an environment where there was activity going on. So I guess, yeah, it was just became everyday life, really. But yeah, not something that I wanted to see. But even people that were brought into the house, people said, oh, no, you know, I don't believe in ghosts, don't believe in that. And then they'd, you know, they'd be in the house overnight or something, you know, and then they'd be a believer by the next day. So it was, yeah, I think I'm probably quite open to those sort of things. So I'm quite sensitive to those sort of things. So I think I do see and hear things anyway. But I think the house was such a hub of activity for things that visitors there were sort of pretty convinced. So I think I had that background bringing up, and that's probably why I became interested in, you know, reading Stephen King books and Alfred Hitchcock and all that sort of thing. So I get it sort of part and parcel my upbringing. Yeah.
I think, to be honest, though, it's better that it is a ghost rather than somebody breaking in, personally.
That is good. But I mean, if you're lying there in bed at night and you can hear, you know, like a door opening and then footsteps, it's just like, you know, slightly, yeah, it's not good. So, yeah, so I've kind of had that background, I guess, which kind of influences what I write at the moment.
Yeah. Did you ever have the experience like I did as a child that certain people, certain relatives would come and babysit me and they'd do it once and then they wouldn't come back?
Yeah, I think so. In fact, I don't know what it was about my mum and dad. They were always like in a series of like haunted houses, you know, wherever we went. We came down to the Isle of Wight. I live on the Isle of Wight and now, but my parents used to have like a little cottage over here, and we used to come over here for holidays and stuff. And that was really haunted. That was like a cottage that was built in, I don't know, the 1600s or something. And then people used to go in that and get really, really sort of quite freaked out by this cottage of like seeing, there was a vicar supposed to have built the house. And people would see this vicar upstairs and they would hear kind of footsteps and things. So yeah, in fact, every property that, you know, we went to, every place we moved to would have been haunted. I guess it that's probably where it all comes from.
So was that your sort of catalyst? Because I'm always interested when people decide to move from the mainland to the Isle of Wight or any of the Channel Islands or something like that, for a lot of people who haven't lived surrounded by the sea, it can be quite daunting. So I would imagine, did you fall in love with the place as a child, Rowena, and it was that the catalyst for why you wanted to sort of relocate there as an adult, or did you move with your family and just basically stay?
I've always had this kind of, I've always loved it over here. It's always kind of a place that's really sort of felt like home. And I think, and I was thinking we were going to move here at some point. And then about 15 years ago, my parents had decided they were going to up sticks from Oxfordshire and they were going to move. And I think then what we sort of thought, oh, well, you know, we'll move as well and everything. I think that's, we sort of followed them down here. So I think it was, I had a different sort of company at the time, and we had an office, and then the office kind of got sold. So we were like, oh, right, okay, we'll go down here. We can kind of work from anywhere. And so, yeah, so we came down, and I guess we followed my parents down here, really. But I think even if they hadn't moved at some point, I'd have probably come down here, because it's, I like the Isle of Wight. It's a little bit rebellious. People don't really toe the line too much down here, and Ventnor's a bit of a kind of artistic hub, really. Mm. And it's full of sort of quite eclectic people and some amazing characters. I'm never going to run out of people to write about here, so it's great. And I love this side of the island. There's kind of little pockets that have got, I suppose, different kind of personalities, like every place. But Ventnor's a lovely place, and it's a great location. So I think I would have ended up here anyway.
Mm. I must admit, when I visited it several times as a teenager in the 80s on family trips, because we had family that lived across the water, across the Solent in Pompey. So I was always struck that, despite the fact it's England and it's, you know, what we're talking, 3 or 4 miles off the coast, if that?
Yeah.
It was like going somewhere else. It was very odd.
I think the fact you get on a ferry, isn't it? It's that sort of, there's that, because you've got that kind of physical barrier of the water, and then you have to get on a boat to actually get there. There's something about that journey, isn't there, that makes it that quite special, really.
Yeah.
So let's hope they don't put a bridge in. It'd be quite nice to keep the barriers.
Well, it could certainly make the Cows Festival interesting. Everybody would have to avoid the bridge, I suppose.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, they've always been talking about putting a bridge in, haven't they? And it's never quite materialised. But
anything's possible. They finally got round to sorting that tower out that they've been on about for decades.
Yeah, that's true. They have built that.
So, obviously, as we were talking at the beginning, you've got this wonderful short film out at the moment, Strange Waters, which you've written and produced.
Yeah.
What was the germination for that? I know we've been talking about these wonderfully weird places around there, because obviously this is set in the Solent, because there is this collection of forts. Are they Peregrine's foibles, are they called?
I think they're called, I'm not sure.
Prime Minister's name.
Palmerston's
Four
Follies. It was in there somewhere. Yeah, there's four forts. There's one, there's like Horse Sand Fort. I think there's St. Helens, and there's No Man's Land. Good name. Mm. So these forts that were basically built in the middle of the Solent. And I think what it was, we'd been in lockdown, and we'd been doing, I was doing some stuff with Director's Cut Theatre, which are up in Southwark Theatre up in London, and everything had moved online sort of during COVID, which ironically kind of opened up lots of opportunities, actually, because they started doing stuff online. They normally obviously do kind of theatre stuff. They started doing films, and actors were sort of, you know, we were kind of creating, doing little films and things, and I taught myself to edit during lockdown. Mm. And then I think when the lockdown was sort of lifting, we were all kind of quite desperate to do something and to kind of make a film, because we've been practicing really for sort of a couple of years. And so, yeah, I guess the location, really, I think I was watching some interview actually with someone from Sundance, one of the judges or something, and he was saying, don't do a film in a living room. He's saying, it's so boring. I don't want to see another living room film. He said, go and pick something extraordinary as a location. And my dad was an architect when he was alive. And so I've always had this real thing for kind of buildings and locations. Obviously, you know, I love all the history and stuff. Mm. And then I think I was on the ferry or something going over, and I was just looking, I was thinking, oh my God, why don't we try and do something here at one of these forts? And yeah, I just was just really cheeky and picked up the phone and found the guy who owned it, who was Mike Clare, who runs Dreams Beds, a sort of big entrepreneur guy. Mm. And he said, yes, we could, a little bit of sort of toing and froing, but yeah, we managed to get over to film on it. So it was really just by picking up the phone, I suppose, and just being a bit pushy and saying, you know, is there any chance we could come over and film on it? So as soon as we kind of got access to it, That was I suppose, a kind of catalyst for it. And I'd had a bit of a story in mind anyway. Mm. And then I sort of did some research on the fort, sort of did my, and the looking at the history, it's just got the most amazing history of these forts. And they were actually built on, they're built on a well. So the water supply comes from a freshwater well that's in the middle. So they sort of bore down when they built them. I don't know how many hundred feet it was, which ironically they were built to protect against the French, and the water supply actually comes from France. And they also had this history that they didn't actually see any, even though they were built because of Napoleon and the threat of the French, they didn't actually ever see any sort of wartime battles or anything like that. But they only kind of posted soldiers over there who couldn't swim.
Yes.
And I thought, well, that is fascinating, you know, that they purposely put people there during the war so that they could jump off and escape. So I had so much material, and I had another story that I'd been kind of writing about, really weirdly, about a well, strangely. And I kind of tied the sort of story into that. So I guess that's where it kind of came from.
Yeah.
That sort of amalgamation of a few things. But yeah, I mean, just to be allowed onto the building anyway, I'd have just written something from scratch to be allowed on there, you know, because it's such an amazing building to get onto. But yeah, it's got all this kind of history, which is just fascinating. And I think the conditions there were pretty horrendous, actually. Yeah, I think it was quite a miserable place to be on there. Obviously not when it was a hotel, but before when it was during the war.
Yeah.
There's all that. And there's a lot of, they've kind of stories of various hauntings and things on there, which most of what you might be aware, Most Haunted did one over there. They filmed over on Spitbank. So yeah, so there's lots to go on, really, to kind of create a story. And again, I think it was, because we were just coming out of lockdown and COVID and everything, and it was like a metaphor, really, for, you know, that kind of isolation that everyone was kind of feeling, and everyone had been kind of cut off from seeing people. So it kind of fitted in, I think.
Yeah.
With the sort of themes of all of that.
Absolutely. I think as someone that's known this location for quite a long time.
Yeah.
I've always been struck by them. I think they're one of the most unique architectural features in the UK, never mind South Coast, Rowena, because they are so unique. I think primarily because of the position on the Solent and where they are, and the fact that they were built despite the fact that they never saw any action. There's a lot about them. And when I was hanging around the South Coast at the end of the 80s, there were already stories then about these haunted forts out at sea that were full of the spirits of suicidal soldiers and all kinds of stories that went on. And we once, my cousin decided to borrow a friend's boat, and we went out one evening to take a tour of them, go on a circle around them. And even just on a lovely summer's evening, they were just seemed to be oozing creepiness. They just look strange, because they are. And obviously some of them were converted into hotels, but when you look at that and you think, here we've got something in the middle of the water, as you say, that they only posted soldiers there who couldn't swim, so they didn't bugger off. I'll swim back to shore and get drunk, I would suspect, because there's many a pub on Portsmouth and South Sea Coast, which would be very tempting for any bored young person, I suspect, at that period.
I doubt they had delivery. Well, you never know. They might have had delivery boats. Who knows?
Yeah, very true. So they've always struck me as a location that if you were going to say, I wonder if that's haunted, they just seem to say, yes, we are.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, when we went, I hadn't been on some before. So it was the first time we went over, and there was nobody on them, and we were very lucky. We had a couple of guides who came over with us, and they'd worked there for a long time. So they were sort of full of the kind of stories and the kind of history of the fort. And that they'd all had kind of incidents on there of things kind of being thrown or, you know. So I mean, one guy was like on there, slept. He was on there on his own at night. I was like, oh my God, I don't even could pay me to go on there. I don't think I'd stay overnight there. But it's only supposed to have kind of one. I think there's one kind of documented ghost, which is a ghost supposed to be called Henry.
Yes.
Which is that one where the cannon backfired and then it killed him. But generally, it's got a very strange atmosphere there. obviously, I said they're not being run as hotels anymore, so they've slightly they're not looking at their best. But it's a bit of a feeling like, you know, if you go into a prison or something, if you go into an old building or like an old sort of sanatorium or something like that, it's got that sort of vibe to it. It's not, they're not happy. Isn't, I mean, I didn't go to the other ones, but that one, it doesn't feel like a happy place, you know. And I think that comes through. Maybe, I'm sure there's lots of reasons with the hotel of why that probably didn't quite work, because getting out to it is difficult as well. But it sort of comes through the building, you know, even if you made it out to be a really gorgeous hotel, it's still, the building has that feel to it. I think that's quite difficult to get away from. So, I mean, one thing when you're doing filming, there's obviously lots of you. So it's not like, you know, you're just there on your own. So there's kind of safety in numbers with these things. You're not, you know, it's not as scary as it could be, because you're not wandering off on your own, really. But it felt very atmospheric, and it felt as though it was kind of a haunted place. And as I said, the guys who'd worked there quite regularly, I think, sort of things happened or got moved around, or yeah. So I think they were just quite used to it there.
Obviously, that leads to the question: did anybody experience anything whilst you were doing the filming there?
Do you know what? Really sadly, we didn't. We're not. I know. I can make something up now and say no. We did at the other location, actually, which I'll come on to, in the Botanic Gardens. We did there, but not actually out on the Seafort. And because of access, so not all of the film is actually filmed over on the Seafort, because logistics, and you know, it's tidal, and if the weather turns, you can't get on it and can't get off it. So yeah, we recreated sort of some of the tunnels somewhere else, so, which is another blimmin' haunted place. Do you know what I mean? Every time I round up, another haunted location there. But yeah, we had a great time filming on there, and it was, yeah, quite a sort of special experience to kind of go over there. But yeah, we unfortunately didn't see any ghosts while we were there.
Oh, well,
I think if you stayed the night there, it'd be probably highly likely you would. And what's quite weird there is the rooms. So they did the rooms out, and then everything's like covered now in like sort of plastic sheeting, which is sort of billowing, and it's all really, yeah, really, really odd. So we were sort of like, oh, I don't think we want to stay on here. So but yeah, we had to be out by night time. So yeah, we didn't get the overnight experience there.
The full package.
No, we didn't get the full package but I'm sure they would have been queuing up to be on film.
Yeah. I think it's really clever that a film of this length, just as I said to you earlier, it's really creepy. You know, you've got an ensemble of five people in the film, and it's just really well made. Like I said to you, it looks beautiful. The picture quality, I mean, there's something about the sea anyway, which kind of elevates things to a different level, as you were saying about the creepiness factor of the place. I think it's like lighthouses are very similar in the fact that they're often in remote locations or slightly set away from a local town or something. And it's this kind of feeling of isolation, despite the fact you might be with other people, you are somewhere that's quite remote, even though that might be difficult for people to comprehend, that it's not that far off the coast, but it's far enough that, as you were saying about it being, you know, in a tidal estuary, if the weather changes, that's it, you're stuck.
Yeah, you are. And the buildings, as you know, if you've taken the boat up by that, they're quite big when you're next to them, and they're quite, you know, they're a lot. Obviously, we just kind of see them going past on the ferry, and they don't look massive, but when you're there, they're quite big buildings. They're quite interesting, and the downstairs, so they're, and they've got a strange kind of perimeter wall that goes around. There's like a very narrow passage that goes all the way round the outside, which is, you can just sort of get one person in it. And I was a bit pathetic, and I didn't get around it. I sent Kev down. I was, right behind you, Kev. I didn't go around that. And I think that's supposed to be sort of something down there. But I think actually, weirdly, the forts are built on kind of sort of sandbanks. So on low tide, they're only on about kind of 8 foot of water. Mm-hmm. They're not, you think, oh, they'll be, you know, they're really far down. But I think that's how they, Victorians managed to kind of build them. Because they are on these sort of sandbanks. But yeah, there's that, you know, that whole thing of kind of being able to, you can only get on and off at certain times, only kind of adds to the kind of atmosphere, I guess, of them. So it'd be interesting to kind of, yeah, see what happens to them now. They're sort of amazing historic buildings. So it'd be nice to think someone's going to look after them in the future, or kind of keep that kind of history.
Yeah.
But it had a really nice bit on the top, which was like a conservatory bit that they built, which is really new. And we're like, oh, this is great up here. This is lovely. We could stay up here. You know, this was a nice bit. But as soon as you went back down to the main building, we were like, no, let's get out of here. We just had enough. No. But yeah, we weren't too enthralled about staying the night over there. They probably wouldn't have let us anyway, so.
Yeah, probably not. But as you were saying, you've obviously had to shoot some of the other bits.
Yeah.
In another haunted location, because obviously, as we were mentioning, you live on the Isle of Wight.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Now, the Isle of Wight likes to put itself forward as the most haunted island in the world.
It does. I don't even know where that quote came from. It does. Yeah. But the tourist board are marketing that one. Yeah, I think so. I mean, there are a lot of ghosts over here. I mean, there are some amazing locations, and there's lots of stories, which I suppose leads to where we filmed the rest of the film, really, which was at a place called the Fenton Botanic Garden.
Mm.
Which used to be a big TB hospital, which is a Royal National Hospital for Diseases of the Chest, I think it was. But it's a huge Victorian building. It was over sort of a quarter of a mile long, this building, which they took down, I think, in the 70s. But it's got an underground, it's got a kind of network of tunnels beneath it. And we were very fortunate to be able to be allowed to film there, because they're not open to the public. And they were hideous, to be honest. I didn't really like it down there at all. But again, there were kind of lots of us. So they've got two, we filmed, there's two separate tunnels. There's one tunnel, which links, actually, there's another, it goes kind of under the road, and there's an old nurses hospital, their residence where they were. Mm-hmm. And I think the tunnel links through to that. And we didn't actually go in all the tunnels. I think we got to a certain point where we're like, no, we'll just leave it here. But they were, they're in quite a poor state anyway. So again, you've kind of got, it's quite atmospheric there, you know, this. And I did read they were the tunnels to the morgue, which probably didn't help. And somebody did tell me, I don't know, maybe they were joking, they did say there was an operation, there was like a clamping table down there, but we didn't go into that bit because I was like, no, we're not going into there. That doesn't look too good. I did read they did some experimental surgery, so I hate to think what maybe happened down there. But they weren't particularly pleasant, those tunnels. What we did, a lot of recreating the tunnels beneath the fort in these two tunnels. And then also, which was quite weird, we went down one of these tunnels and there was like some sort of like headstone down there. We sort of shone a light on it and it like had my birthday on there. So I had April the 14th. I was like, no, is it a good sign? I'm not sure. So yeah, that they were quite strange, those tunnels. And they also had, then there's another tunnel, which is, I think it's about 400 foot, the tunnel, and it goes from the gardens through to the cliff. So it goes out to the sea. And then there's basically a pretty much sheer drop the other side. I think originally they got kind of the planning for it, because the idea was that people who had TB, I don't know actually what they're going to do on the end of a cliff, but to take them out to sort of give them kind of sea air and things.
Yes.
And then it just got, I think it got used as a waste tunnel, but it's got like the old tracks down it. So they obviously sort of were running body parts I don't know what they were running, but that is a horrible tunnel, and I quite a few people actually got injured in the tunnel, which is really, really a bit bizarre. But we had when we first went down there, I was down there with my son, and we were just sort of shouting out down the tunnel as you do, and there was like a rock that was thrown down the tunnel, which was quite strange.
Yeah.
And we were like, right, that's a bit odd, because it wasn't like something that was just falling from the sort of, you know, the ceiling or anything of the tunnel. It was thrown down the tunnel. So that was very strange. And as I said, yeah, we had a few things when we was kind of filming. The electrical equipment went in the tunnels quite a bit. There was a few, you know, the normal kind of draining of batteries and things, but a few people did kind of injure themselves in the tunnel. Well, there's not much to injure yourself on there, but a few people kind of hit their head and then they're feeling a bit dizzy and stuff. So yeah, I don't know, but it didn't feel very nice down there. And I didn't go down there that tunnel on my own. Didn't fancy it down there. not keen. I wasn't keen. But yeah, so we did a lot of filming in these sort of two tunnels under the, which are now the Ventnor Botanic Gardens. So that was kind of really, really interesting. And I think it promotes itself as one of the most haunted places on the island, because I think they do quite a few ghost walks around there. And people often see sort of like a lot of patients or people in the gardens and things like that. And I know when they knocked it down, when they pulled it down, I think, I can't remember when it was, in the 70s or whatever, I think it closed in late 60s or something. Mm. They had lots of problems on the demolition with the kind of workmen sort of seeing things or kind of injuries. And for some reason, it kind of centered around like the operating theatre. They tried to pull that down and they had loads of problems, and they had sort of a ball and chain, and the steel cable snapped.
Oh.
And then they also had, they brought in like a sort of one of those caterpillar kind of tractors, I don't know what they're even called. And some huge bit of masonry fell on the cab and like crushed people. And yeah, it was all wind, and they took it down by hand in the end. But they sort of regularly saw sort of ghosts and things on the site when they were doing it. So it was sort of quite known for that, because they were sort of disturbing it, I suppose, and taking it there. But there's nothing there of the hospital now. It's just that bit is all kind of car park. But yeah, it's supposed to have a lot of people who can kind of smell kind of medicinal smells, or people want, as I said, wandering through the garden or whatever. So it's kind of fairly known for being haunted.
Mm. I think it's one of those things about the UK that when we talk about these places that were set up for the unfortunate people that were suffering from, as they called it at the time, consumption, which became tuberculosis.
Yeah.
I think often when we talk about haunted locations of that nature, everybody considers them to be in the US. And I think so many people have completely forgotten how worldwide a problem tuberculosis was.
Oh, yeah.
That there's loads of these little sites all dotted around the South Coast, because obviously the train of thought in the medical world at that time was that it was pollution or something that was causing this. And therefore, the best thing that people could do was bracing fresh air, and they'd stick people outside. I was speaking to an author from Wales called Mark Rees, and he was talking about a facility that was the same in Wales, which is quite remarkable when you think about the history of Wales and the industrialisation of the area.
Yeah.
That they would stick a tuberculosis hospital in the middle of this beautiful area, but at the end of the day, it's still surrounded by coal fields at the end of the day. Even if they are 10 miles, away. So I think it's surprising to me that we don't hear more stories like this from around some of these other locations near the coast, because there were a lot of them.
Yeah. I mean, I did sort of quite a lot of research. I looked into sort of the hospital and things. So obviously, if you don't know Ventnor, but it's got a bit of a kind of microclimate. Mm. And because of that, they were brought here because they thought the sort of sea air and everything had sort of beneficial. And they used to wheel them out actually in the beds into the garden. But you can look through the records, which is really fascinating online, of the people who were in the hospital. And they were all really young. That really kind of struck me. You know, you're expecting older people. Obviously, you know, we've kind of got this thing of TB or kind of anything like that is... Well, I don't know. I always thought it was like an older thing, but they were very young. You know, there was people in their 20s and teens and 30s were the bulk of the people really who were in there.
Mm.
But yeah, really fascinating. You can kind of go in and read all the records of what they, you know, of how they were treated. And interestingly, they had a sort of handle slightly about sort of disinfectant and things then. You know, they weren't allowed to share kind of magazines, or, which is quite interesting you know, now what we've just come out with COVID and stuff, and they had to kind of burn their, when they had to sort of burn their, they weren't allowed handkerchiefs, they had to have sort of like these paper towels and things. So they're obviously sort of going along the right lines, weren't they?
Mm.
But yeah, a fascinating building of and this kind of history of this sort of Victorian, how they used to treat people. But I don't know. So some of it I was reading, they did, so I don't know what they did in terms of like operations. I don't know, but it said like experimental surgery. So I hate to think what that even would be.
Yes.
But yeah, it makes you kind of wonder, I guess. But
I suspect it may be something to do with draining lungs and iron lungs and things
like that. Yeah, it could be. It could well be. I don't know.
Ooh.
But yeah, there's lots there. And there's lots, I mean, even on the island, like some of the guys, there's one that's being, which is an old sanatorium at the moment here, which is being changed into some flats. yeah, great. And they are having, but you know, the guys who are working on there, I know a couple of them, and they are, you know, not the sort of people who are going to be, who would expect a ghost to be there or it being haunted, but they're all like, no, there's just strange stuff going on here. They're having sort of loads of problems at the site with, but you know, basically accidents, things being moved, that kind of, you know, it sounds ridiculous, but they're all caught, you know, they're the sort of people who are not going to, you know, if they say it, I believe them. Yeah. So there's some weird goings on. I don't know really why you'd probably want to have a flat in an old sanatorium, really, but that's kind of going on. So it's interesting. There's lots of places like that, I think, sort of around the island, but that's one that's sort of fairly well known.
Yeah. Is it one of those places, as you were mentioning, were people seeing things before the hospital was demolished, or as you were saying, do you think the demolishing of the building was the catalyst to release things? Because I've spoken to people over the years, and it's occasionally this seems to be some kind of explosion in regards to paranormal events that obviously these buildings have a long history. And when you think about how many people went through it and how many people unfortunately probably passed away through tuberculosis and other associated diseases and things, you realize just how many people it affected, and the mortality rate in those days was not good. Tuberculosis was usually a death sentence for many at that period of time. So there's clearly a lot of grief and sadness sort of encapsulated in these localities. So was it something that has only really exploded over the last 50 years in regards to these hauntings, you know, when it's come to this particular location on the island?
Do you know what? I think since they pulled it down, I think it's definitely that there seems to be sort of more activity there, I think, since they pulled it down. But it's strange. It's quite a peaceful place, really. There, it doesn't feel, apart from the horrible tunnel, it doesn't feel, when you wander around there, anything kind of sort of sinister. It's not like being over on the fort, which feels sort of quite oppressive. It feels quite, it's got quite a nice kind of ambience, a sort of calming, as though people were kind of happy there generally, apart from the ones who are having the iron lungs, obviously. But I don't know. I think quite often, does it, if you kind of pull stuff down, that seems to set off kind of activity, doesn't it, in areas, you know, sort of not being respectful of various things, or people have dug up various sort of grave sites or whatever. So I don't know. It's got, as I said, they do sort of quite a few kind of ghost walks and stuff around there now. So I would say it's probably since it's been pulled down.
Yeah.
It's kind of risen a little bit, I think.
Mm. I mean, I've always been impressed with the amount of ghost stories that come from the Isle of Wight. My first introduction to the history of this place was Peter Underwood, which is usually my introduction to most ghost stories in the UK, Rowena, due to my voracious appetite for anything he wrote as a young man. So what other great locations are known for their haunting reputations on the island? Because like I say, there seems to be some really good ones. And obviously it's an island with a fantastic history. It's seen all kinds of crazy things go on over the last 1500 years. So one would suspect there are all kinds of spirits and ghosts wandering around.
Yeah, I think that there's lots. Oh, there's so many places over here. I mean, you've kind of got obviously the Isle of Wight was a big kind of Victorian resort. So you've got your places like kind of Osborne House, all those kind of, you've got like Appledurcombe was which is near here actually, is which is a ruin now. I had the sort of gardens done by sort of Capability Brown, but that is odd around there. That's weird. That's a ruin now, but that's supposed to have several ghosts going sort of wandering around, people seeing sort of stage coaches, and I think it's got probably you know, your standard grey lady who normally turns up. But there's some great places. Carisbrook Castle is really fantastic. I don't know whether you ever went over there, but that's, again, that didn't actually see any fighting at all in Carisbrook Castle, but that's where King Charles I was kept before he was beheaded, and he did try to escape several times. Yeah. But that's got lots of, I don't think actually King Charles I is supposed to be a kind of spectre there, but that they've got a man, you can walk around, quite a lot of people sort of take dogs to walk and stuff around the castle in the evening and things. So quite a lot of people have seen various sort of different characters, like a man was seen walking a kind of a pack of dogs, as you do. And people have sort of thought, oh, it's somebody dressed up and there's being a character or whatever, and they've kind of disappeared. So there's lots of activity, and there's a well where there's there's quite a famous sort of donkey that runs the wheel there, and they put it in, but now for kind of donkey's well-being, the donkey only can do like 5 minutes at a time. But a long time ago, they used to have this sort of donkey that worked the wheel and the well, and there's supposed to be a girl who fell down there. And if you look down, sometimes you can sort of see her face underneath the well. That's been seen by quite a few people there. So that's it's a really atmospheric place there. That's, you know, that's fantastic. And we've got places like, there's like Knight and Gorges. Do you know that one?
Is that supposed to be the disappearing house?
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Well, so the house isn't there anymore. Mm-hmm. And then people go for a sort of vigil at New Year's Eve, and there's two gateposts there. And you're supposed to, the house is supposed to appear, and people see like kind of the dogs on top of the two gateposts. But it is quite weird around there. It's got a bit of an odd feeling. There's a kind of a wood that goes around it. So quite a few people have taken pictures and seen sort of various orbs and things. But that's quite a well-known sort of spot. But there's just, you know, there's loads of kind of haunted places, but there's weird stuff over here as well, which I think is really great. There's like an old, if you like any look at these sort of things where they kind of, you know, break into, I can't think what they're called. They sort of, you know, people who sort of go around derelict places.
Urban explorers.
Yeah, that's the one. There's like an old boot, like somewhere in the landslip, which is like this, a full, I don't know how tall it is, like a sort of 30 foot Victorian sort of boot, which has got all these vines kind of growing out of it somewhere in the undercliff. And I don't even know what it was or what it was. Maybe someone did it as a kind of kids thing in the Victorian times. I don't know. But there's lots of really sort of strange things that you think, why would that be there? You know, there's a landslip here as well, which has got, it's got like a big Victorian wishing seat that's carved out of the stone. You go down, the landslip is kind of like an area. It goes through to rocks called Devil's Chimney, which are like sheer rocks, and you walk down these steps. And it's a bit kind of like going back into sort of some prehistoric jungle down there. But it's called the landslip because over time it's kind of fallen, bits have fallen into the sea. So it's on kind of different levels. But yeah, there's like an old weird Victorian seat there, just in the middle of like randomly, you know, you just stumble across this thing. I don't know who put that there, carved out this rock.
Do you think that's down to the fact, because I know the Isle of Wight was kind of just minding its own business, and then all of a sudden the Victorians fell in love with the place, didn't they?
Yeah.
So do you think they just came and started building really weird sort of tourist attractions?
I don't really know. I don't know where all these sort of strange things have kind of come from. I mean, there's also got the sort of association with Dickens here. So Dickens is supposed to have spent, a big Dickens fan, and he was supposed to spend quite a lot of summers over here. Well, not supposed to, he did. And he wrote lots of letters, so they can kind of trace various characters back from his stories to people who are here, which is quite interesting. And there was there's a lady who in Bond Church who they based who he based Miss Havisham on from Great Expectations. So the lady who was jilted and was hanging around in a wedding dress with the windows closed, and that was supposed to be based on a lady in Bond Church here who was also jilted, and then she basically kind of locked herself away in the attic of this house, and they sort of I don't know how much of this is true, but it was supposed to be that she didn't see anybody, and they sort of passed her dinner through like a little hatch, and then she sort of paid the maid out through on the empty bowl, and then put it back, and she was I mean it's to be honest it's really sad. I think she was there. I can't remember how many. I've probably got it written down somewhere, but I think she was there for about like 19 years or something ridiculous. She just wouldn't leave the house, and she was in this little kind of attic, and a gravestone's up at the local sort of church here. So there's lots of little stories like that, which are really interesting. So I thought that would make a fantastic program. Just sort of all these little odd little stories, characters, maybe that kind of Dickens had base them on, real people, and you can actually go to the house where and see where this lady was. There's loads of kind of bits and pieces. And then you've also got, I guess, you've got like on the back of the white, you've got, it was a very notorious for, there's a lot of shipwrecks out there. So basically you're kind of southern side of the island going to kind of West White all along there, and the beaches along there are supposed to be haunted. Quite a lot of people have sort of seen boats, like old fishing boats, coming in at night, or fishermen have been out there and they've seen somebody kind of walking along and they've kind of disappeared and stuff. But there's a lot of kind of smuggling and wrecking that used to happen out there, so that's kind of got all that history, which is really fascinating. Obviously you've got the lighthouses, as you were saying about lighthouses, which again I find endlessly fascinating. There's St Catherine's Lighthouse, the Needles Lighthouse, there's St Catherine's, there's quite a famous picture of a sort of figure stood in at the top of the lighthouse, so that's sort of supposed to be kind of all that stretch is, it's very kind of odd really. But yeah, so that there's all that kind of maritime stuff as well. Mm-hmm. We had a thing like several years ago, which was again just a really bizarre thing, and it was a classic case of it was foggy. But we had a little house that was sort of near the water, so it's a house, like a little chalet thing down by the sea, and we kind of were walking along, and there wasn't anybody there, and that everything sort of went very odd, and we saw like a really old fishing boat, and then there was like loads of like chattering of children sort of down by the shore, which was quite strange as there was nobody there. And it didn't last a very long, it probably lasted for about 30 seconds, and then it sort of went, and then the boat went, and it just sort of went. It was almost like kind of you were in a bit of a kind of time shift. It was really strange. But that's, I think, apparently, sort of reading quite often, people sort of see old boats and things. And I don't know why, but somehow I think when things are sort of foggy, somehow that kind of creates the right conditions for it. I don't know why, it sort of muffles everything.
Yeah.
But yeah, so there's a few kind of bits, but lots of ghost stories kind of around here of, different places to visit and explore. So the one we did, so the last film that I've just shot, which we've just finished this week, actually, called The Day of the Sun Dog.
Yeah.
We just, again, we shot in this. It's a bit, this one's not so scary, this one, but it's still a bit of a weird film. We found this house. We went for a walk. It's in a place called Wellow. I won't say the address of it, but
yes.
the lady, probably got millions of people turning up at her house. I think it was Boxing Day or something. My cousin's house was out that way, and we'd gone for a walk because I think his wife had wanted to drag us across the fields for some strange reason. We had all been drinking. We're like, why are we going for a walk?
It's the British customer week.
Yeah.
Boxing Day walk.
Yeah.
We're walking off your Christmas Day dinner.
We're all like, you know, my eye thinking being dragged across this field. And we were sort of loitering at the back, and we were in the middle of this field. You wouldn't have seen this house otherwise. And we kind of look back, and there's this incredible sort of building that looks like, I don't know, it looks a bit like an old chapel, like a sort of medieval chapel. And it's right on the edge of these cornfields. It's just fantastic. Really just the most amazing kind of silhouette. We were like, look at that house. And so, yeah, I was there, you know, a few months later. And then really cheekily, I just thought, I'll just try it and just knock on the woman's door and see if I didn't know it was a woman at that point, but knock on the door and see what they say. And the lady was actually quite into sort of spirits and things in the house. And the house, I think it was built, I can't remember what the date was, but 1700s. Mm. And the downstairs is really, really old. And so they've kind of kept it looking like, I don't know, it's a very old kind of cottage, or I don't know what it was. And that had, strangely, a well room in it as well. And she said, oh yeah, there's a gentleman who's down here. We have to sort of be respectful because he's in here. So that was quite interesting that we then stumbled upon another place that was haunted. So we kind of had to do it. When we started, we were like, right, we just thought, this sounds a bit stupid, but we'll just talk to him, just say, please don't affect our electrical equipment. And we're just doing a little bit of shooting down here. So yeah, but it was another sort of really odd location, but yeah, a brilliant, brilliant house, to film in for this one. So this one isn't really sort of a ghost story, but the house was haunted. So,
So is this, because obviously your latest film features Paul McGann, who most people
know
from the Doctor Who film.
Yes.
Was that now? Was that mid 90s?
I think so. Yeah. I'm not sure what year it was. With Nell and I, of course, which I loved that film. I think, you know, a lot of people might bring up as students, it was kind of always a bit close to the mark.
Yeah. Camberwell Carrot.
Yeah, that's the one. The guy who, but I can't even think who it was. But yeah, that's apparently got a following of its own, the Camberwell Carrot.
Yes, it has.
That he was saying to me. But yeah, I mean, Paul was fantastic. And to get him on the film was just a dream, really, because he liked the script. And it turns out he is quite a fan of sort of dark. This one's more about the kind of signs from the afterlife, I guess this one's about. And it's got a dog in it as well.
Mm.
And he quite likes dogs, which is very handy.
Yes.
So, but yeah, he liked it. And Kerry Taylor was in it as well, who's used to be in Hollyoaks a long time ago. And she's in The Bay. So she was brilliant as well. Yeah, both of them together, working with them was actually fantastic. And I was just basically saying that Paul, it was quite nice. Again, it's a slightly kind of black comedy, and he doesn't, he's tended to come to do quite a few kind of serious roles.
Mm.
So it was quite nice. He's got a very good sense of humour. He's very dry.
Yeah.
The sense of humour. And he improvised some bits in this, which was great. We were like, well, we've got to keep it here. We've got to keep it here because it's so good. So yeah. So I'm hoping that will kind of, be a sort of a big hit with his fans. But it was quite nice because he has got that. He has got this just really nice, manner about him, and he with Nell and I, obviously, you know, was a sort of black comedy.
Yeah.
But so hopefully we've kind of allowed him to sort of be sort of a bit free with so improvising some sort of slightly black comedy moments in it. So hopefully that will go down well with everybody.
Absolutely. And I suppose, Rowena, as well, when you're a writer and a producer, it's, You take this as a massive compliment when you have someone of that ilk that wants to work on it because they've read what you've written and decided that, yeah, I'm really interested in this project.
Yeah, I mean, that is, that is amazing. You know, to think that you've written something and somebody's interested in it and they like it is always a massive privilege. And it's always very surreal, like whenever you write anything, to have it performed by people, because you're thinking, God, this was in my head and now, you know, it's someone's acting it. It's always an honour, and I'm always humbled by it, you know, that you've kind of come up with something in your head and then people are performing it. And, you know, when you get really great actors, they're adding to it as well.
Mm.
Or doing stuff that you haven't seen. So yeah, it's a very surreal, the whole thing is always quite a surreal process anyway. But yeah, working with both of them was was just really fantastic, and we were so excited to get them on this project.
I suppose, would you say that you've been a little surprised? Because obviously we've spoken for a bit, and obviously I've seen some of your updates and stuff. Are you surprised how popular Strange Waters has been? Because it has garnered a lot of nominations. It's won several awards.
Yeah.
I would imagine for someone who's kind of really sort of stepping out for the first time in this field at this level, Rowena.
Yeah.
It doesn't get better than that, really, does it? Start off and then your second project of this ilk. Are you working with Andy McLeod again, I believe, directing this?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, he's fantastic.
So, really, it seems like everything seems to be falling into place. You're having a fabulous year so far.
Yeah. Do you know what? I'm very lucky. I mean, the film's been really well received, and we've got some great publicity from it. And we've actually done, we're kind of going into the sort of bigger film festivals now with Strange Waters to see how that did. So we've kind of done the smaller and the mid kind of festivals, which has done quite well at. And then, so we've got the kind of bigger one next. And we've actually done a little bit of an edit on it. Because we sat and got some, just where we had kind of, it's really nice to get audience feedback. It's quite, when you're kind of watching it, even if you're watching it on like a really huge TV screen, it's not the same as watching it in the cinema. And it is quite interesting watching it with different audiences as well.
Mm.
So obviously if you've got the audiences in the evening, you know, sometimes they've had a drink and they're a bit more relaxed. You've got your daytime audiences.
Yes.
So it's been, it's been really fascinating watching kind of people's reactions to it and looking maybe. So we've just kind of, I think there's a couple of bits with the pacing that we've done, and I think there was one bit on the storyline we've sort of made a little bit clearer. We've got this edit, and so we'll be going to the kind of bigger festivals. But yeah, amazing, really. I mean, you don't expect, you know, but we had a brilliant crew, and we had brilliant actors on it, and we'd all worked with them before, and then we'd met a crew over here who, really weirdly, I'd gone to Portsmouth University with, and I didn't know that. We were all in the same year, and how freaky is that? There was like three of us on the crew, and we'd all gone to Portsmouth, and they did film, but they've been, you know, they're not like me who's come into it fairly recently. They've been doing it, you know, they've been doing it, so they're in university. So, you know, they can do it all kind of standing on their head. So they've, the expertise in the crew is amazing, really. So that's obviously helped. I'm a bit of an annoying perfectionist when it comes to things. So, you know, I'm cracking the whip with them all. They probably all hate me. It's been an amazing start with it. So we're just kind of rolling with it. I've got another few projects that are coming up that I've asked to be producer on, which is brilliant. So yeah, there's lots I've got kind of sort of in the pipeline this year that we're working on. So yeah, it just kind of seems to be snowballing, really. I'm just going with it and enjoying the ride while I can. But then I think as well, I think also, you know, to some extent you do create your own luck. I think when you make a film, quite a lot of filmmakers don't promote themselves probably as much as they should. And I guess I've got a business background as well.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of quite hot on the kind of marketing of it and you know, and seeing what we can kind of do with it. So some of the luck is created, I think, because, you know, you meet people and you do the sort of networking and you do all that bit. So I think that just kind of opens doors. But and generally the filmmaking community is brilliant. You know, everyone is really supportive of each other.
Yeah.
You know, everybody wants to help. And I think likewise, if you're making a film as well, if you're people who are kind of filmmakers out there, if you're making a film, it's not like doing theatre. When you're doing a film, everybody's suddenly really interested. Before, when you do sort of plays, people are like, oh, that's lovely, you're doing a play. How lovely. But when you're doing a film, everybody is suddenly like super helpful and really interested. So it's got that sort of perceived glamour. But yeah, and the reality is as well, you know, you're going to these, we were lucky enough to be shown a number 6 cinema over in Portsmouth, which is the most amazing cinema in like their historic dockyard, which has got like the biggest screen, I think, like south of England. It's like this big, huge curved screen, and it's so kind of plush in there. They're an independent cinema, and they're trying to get like people to go along to it. Just incredible experience. But all the cinemas have been really, really hit by COVID.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're trying to get people back to the cinemas and they're struggling. Got this thing that's all this big kind of glamorous thing, but, you know, it's being run by like one or two people a lot of the time with it, you know, these cinemas.
Mm.
So it's interesting seeing what's happening with kind of cinemas, how they can try and get audiences back there. So obviously like things like Cannes and all the things that have just been on are quite, you know, fundamental in trying to get people, you know, back into the cinema. But it's difficult when people have got huge TVs at home, isn't it?
It is. To be fair, though, I think that throughout the whole pandemic, as a regular cinema goer myself, I'm quite fortunate that I live in Sheffield. We've got two or three beautiful cinemas.
Yeah.
We've got the Showroom and we've got the Curzon. We've also got Abbeydale Picture House, which was built in the 1920s. Beautiful Art Deco. Doesn't do very many showings, Rowena, but it does do specialised silent films with organ accompaniment, and it'll show classic films, it'll do double bills and stuff, and they do sort of they used to, they've not started them back up again, but they do like jumble sales where you could come into the amphitheatre and just have a wander around.
Yeah,
I love going to places. Yeah, I like going to the big cinema to watch a blockbuster, but I also love going to the specialised cinemas to see a specific type of film or something a bit different. So when you have venues like that, it's imperative that the community supports them, not only for the cinema itself, but also a lot of them do tend to support people like yourself and other independent filmmakers who are just setting out in the world of film, really.
Yeah, I mean, they would have been absolutely fantastic. I mean, they put us on before the Nicolas Cage film. You know, it doesn't get any better than that, really.
Brilliant.
So, yeah, we kind of walked away with big Nicolas Cage posters, which was great. So, yeah, you know, fantastic support for kind of local filmmaking. So if people can get along to independent cinemas, I would advise them to do it because they are just, you know, these are fascinating places. But yeah, hopefully, you know, people will start to go back. But yeah, if people can kind of support local cinema, then that's got to be a good thing.
Absolutely. And I think the last subject I want to touch on before I let you return to your spooky accommodation.
Yeah, great.
Keeping you occupied until you have
keep talking.
Until you have to turn all the candles back on. Is like me, Rowena, you are something of a bit of a Bigfoot obsessive. Now,
I am, yeah.
How on earth did you fall into this wormhole? I blame it all on Arthur C. Clarke as a child, Rowena. What's your excuse?
That's true. Yeah, that Arthur C. Clarke, I think it was that. And I think it was seeing that footage. Well, I don't even know what year that even came out, but I don't know. I've always been really obsessed with Bigfoot. Yeah, I mean, I love finding Bigfoot for a start. I know I've seen every episode about a thousand times. And I think there's just something, again, just really kind of intrigued, you know, anything to do with the monsters, I love, you know, Loch Ness, anything like that, I love it. And I just find it quite, I'm just, you know, there's so many things in this world that we don't understand, aren't there, you know, and things that are not yet discovered. And I think that's the draw of it, really, isn't it? That things could be out there that we haven't discovered. So I suppose that's the kind of fascination, is just being curious with the world.
Mm.
I think, you know, man knows very little about the environment we're in, you know, whether it's kind of ghosts or Loch Ness Monster or Bigfoot or anything like that. So I guess that's the kind of fascination. And then I don't know really why particular Bigfoot, but yeah, and then I'm sort of the North American Bigfoot Center over on Patreon over there as well, in Boring in Oregon.
Yes.
The Sliff's place.
Yeah.
So then I kind of go involved. Yeah, I don't really know why the fascination is. I guess it all stems from probably as a child and looking at the famous footage. Maybe the seed was planted there somewhere.
I think because obviously we're both of a similar vintage, shall we say? And
I'm clearly younger, Paul.
No, you are. I think you are. So anyway, in regards to that, I think it's really odd that for people like me and you, we saw the same thing and it sparked something in us that's lasted 40 years. And yet there were probably millions of people who saw that because it was an extremely popular show. It was massive at the time. I remember it's what they used to call destination TV. You know, you had to be there watching it. And in the old days over here in the UK when we had three channels back then, I think it was even before the birth of Channel 4. So I find it peculiar that for people like us, it really sort of fired something up. And for millions of other people, they just went, oh, that's a bit odd. I don't know whether it's because I know enough about old films to know that that's no suit.
Yeah.
That, because that always, you know, oh, it's somebody in a suit. Well, and I've always said this, if you want me to believe it's a fake, I want you to recreate that film using all the technology they had in 1967. If you can do that with the budget that Gimlin and Patterson were supposed to have, then go for it. And I'll eat the largest slice of humble pie you can do. However, I've seen enough films of that era to know they're nonsense.
Yeah, I mean, they did. I mean, there's obviously been loads of documentaries on it, but they've sort of tested it, haven't they, really? Yes. And they haven't been able to disprove it at all, that footage. But really, it's the way that sort of the kind of fur moves, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
That a suit wouldn't be able to kind of mimic that, or you wouldn't be able to recreate that on, as you said, in a film then. But it's, it's such a fascinating, subject. And I will have to go over, and I am going to go over to Bigfoot Center.
Yeah.
Either probably next year, I'm going to go and visit them because I'd love to go over and have a look. But maybe it is this thing, this fascination with that what's out there that we don't actually know. Would it be really disappointing if we found one? I don't know. You know, would that then be?
Yeah.
What would happen then?
Is it the mystery that keeps us so
maybe
entranced in it? But I'm like you. I remember a few years ago, I got through to the final selection of a very popular British game show where you could win up to £250,000, shall we say.
Yeah.
And I had to do an interview with them to basically say, well, what would you spend the money on?
Yeah.
So I honestly said, well, you know, if I'm lucky enough to win £250,000, the first thing I'm going to do is me and my brother are going to go to Washington State in America, and we're going to go looking for Bigfoot.
Yeah.
And they just burst out laughing. And they went, are you joking? And I went, no. And I think they were like, oh, I think they thought they'd really offended me because they were laughing because they thought I was joking.
Yeah.
And they said, are you being serious? I said, oh, absolutely. I said, me and my brother's got a deal that if either of us comes into money, whether we win the lottery or whatever, Rowena, then we're going to take the other one out there. Obviously, this is like 8 years ago. So I didn't know anybody. Now, I've spoken to David Ellis and Shane Corson from the Olympic Project. I have an open invitation to join them.
Oh, fantastic.
If I'm in a position where I can get there.
So, yeah.
So now if I had an audition and I got through to a game show and I was lucky enough to win some money, now I've actually got people I can go and hang out with. And I've spoken to plenty of guys involved in the Olympic Project.
Yeah.
Shelley Covington Montana and Amy Bew and people like that, and got to know some amazing Bigfooters. So I just find it thoroughly enthralling, but also the fact that whenever I see anything from there, And it's the same in areas of Canada. Regardless of the fact that you're looking for a hairy bipedal creature of some description.
Yeah.
The whole area is just beautiful. And obviously, as you mentioned about Cliff Barrettman's Bigfoot Centre in Boring.
Yeah.
Oregon's another one. It's just such a beautiful part of the world that even if you didn't find anything, which people better than you or I have spent decades looking for these things. Peter Byrne is a prime example. I just sit there and just drink in the vistas because it's just beautiful. I look at some of the footage that comes out of Canada, these places.
Yeah.
When people go, oh, well, we've been everywhere. We've seen everything. We know everything. And I think when you look at people like Justin Chernopesky, who's a filmmaker out of Canada who runs a wonderful channel called Mountain Beast Mysteries.
Yeah.
He goes out into the wilds of Canada and there's nothing there. There's nobody there at all.
Yeah.
All you can see is trees and mountains. And you think, are you honestly telling me there's nothing in there? Because it's incredible.
Compared to here, isn't it? I mean, it's massive, isn't it?
Yeah.
And in fact, my cousin, who's also really obsessed with Bigfoot, Dave Thomas, who's a TV editor.
Yeah.
And he'd put together a pilot for doing a Bigfoot thing over here in the UK, because there are some weird stories, even though from like Scotland, and there's some ancient kind of stories of like Bigfoot over in like the UK. Mm. And he's collated all these kind of stories. So yeah, he's another Bigfoot kind of expert. But yeah, I mean, you go, it's vast there, isn't it? I mean, you look at the forest there and anything could be in there, couldn't they? I mean, you know, it's immense. Here we've, you know, got a small kind of cluster of trees compared to where we're at. But it's just such a fascinating It's such a fascinating topic. But then I think as well, it is becoming more accepted, you know, even like with UFOs and things now, it hasn't quite got the stigma, I think, that it used to have. You know, the papers, there always used to be, oh, like little green men and people talking about this. And and now people are sort of coming out and sort of talking about it a bit more. So I think there's a bit of a shift that people are actually thinking, well, actually, going on to UFOs, but, you know, maybe we're... Well, not, it's kind of ignorant. You're the only life in the universe, really. It's a little bit arrogant. But I think there is, I think society is being more open to these sort of things now, and the possibility of, we don't know what's in our world, really. There's loads of things. But I think society's catching up. We're just ahead of our time.
Yeah. I'll agree there. I think it is a very interesting, like you say, for me, as someone that's loved monsters and UFOs and ghosts and everything else.
Yeah.
Spontaneous human combustion to mysteriously disappearing people and ghost ships and all sorts. I love it all. Drink it all in. I find it very odd that we're in a position, here we are in 2022, where the conversation, as you just said there, about UFOs is actually probably for the first time in my life, Rowena, it's being taken seriously. And we've got past, as you say, whenever they used to talk about UFOs, they would mention little green men, tinfoil hats, and play the X-Files theme.
Yeah.
And now, thank God, we seem to have got to a point where we're actually being mature about it and looking at it in a scientific manner. And as you say, I find it, even on a mathematical basis, the chances that we are the only life form in the entire universe, I find more ridiculous than the fact that we're not.
Yeah. I completely agree. I guess it's more whether they're, and you would hope with kind of UFO, if they are here, that they would be friendly, as though they would have probably destroyed us by now.
Well, yes. Well, we've always got to take on the words of Stephen Hawking, that, you know, the reason they're not reaching out is because they're not. But who knows? I'm sure there are millions of other people who would say that their friends from above are lovely people.
This is true. I'm sure we will find that out fairly soon.
Yeah. But I think, as you were saying, though, I think cryptozoology is having a very similar thing, that it seems to be coming a more mature thing. Obviously, depending which rabbit hole you fall down online, you can end up in all kinds of weird places. However, I think with people like Cliff, because Cliff strikes me as a very genuine, honest man, and I've got a lot of time for Cliff. He seems a lovely man, and I wish him and his wife the best of luck with that, because he's clearly very passionate about the subject, and other people in the BRFO, and as I mentioned, the Olympic Project, and there are some amazing researchers in North America.
Yeah, they are.
And some here in the UK, some people I've become really good friends with, people like Richard Freeman and the like, from the Centre of Fortean Zoology. So
yeah, fantastic.
I think for me, when we look at that, it seems a bit strange, whereas the paranormal seems to have completely fallen off a cliff into the world of entertainment now.
Yeah, that's true, I guess. I guess that's to do with programmes are being put out, maybe. Mm. I don't know. I guess some of the programming for the ghost stuff isn't as serious as it could be.
Yeah. But that's because ghost hunting is boring, really.
Yeah.
Having done many a watching somebody's face for 7 hours in a darker room going, hello?
Yeah.
And nothing happening is not exciting television. So I kind of understand it, but I think, you know, I've spoken to some parapsychologists from North America, and once again, it's one of those that unless you know about it or know where to go, you'd think nobody's taking it seriously anymore. But there are some very eminent scientists in the US and Canada who are digging into these things again. And I think it's they've got it like cryptozoology. You've got to keep it hush hush, or you lose your funding.
It's very strange. It always amazes me that why science sort of debunks or in historically has. You know, obviously there are people that they're not happening as much, I guess. But surely people should be looking into it and thinking, why are these things happening? You know, what people are obviously having experiences.
Yeah.
You know, because it would be, you know, it would be a revelation, wouldn't it?
If you could.
You know, discover why there were ghosts, or where people saw this, or they heard noises, or, you know, there's a lot to be explained, and you can't just sort of debunk the theories of people just saying it's, oh, they made it up, or, you know, there's obviously something that's happening. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's why I sort of find it sort of fascinating, because it's something, again, that we have yet to discover. You know, we don't know. So again, I think society is changing a little bit, and it's becoming more open to these kind of conversations, which it needs to have, really. But you need some pretty, as you said, you know, people who have got some credibility who are then sort of discussing things. You know, you need it to go down that route, really, don't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And as a fellow haunted house resident as a child, I'm sure people say, oh, so I lived in it was a converted vicarage. People say, oh, it was a very old house.
Yeah.
Listen, I saw enough and I heard enough. I know enough to know. It wasn't creaky floorboards and timbers settling. When you find a gravestone, when you find a grave in your front garden, then stuff starts happening.
Yeah.
There's only so much coincidence can explain away.
I think that's it. And I think it's actually quite, I'm not going to say traumatic, but it's, you know, if you've grown up in that, it's difficult as a child because, you know, you've got to try and make sense of it. And it's, you know, you've got things going on which are quite frightening, really, you know, or you're hearing sounds or noises or seeing things. And so you've got to try and live with it and you've got to try and make sense of it. I think it's all very easy for people to say, oh, yeah, you know, kids' fertile imagination. But, you know, you were brought up in a house where it had activity in it. Hmm. It's quite difficult to deal with because, you know, you're kind of watching all the bloody time, you know, if you're sleeping, like, what's that, you know. So I think I've purposely now always tried to buy my own houses that aren't haunted. I've always gone for things that looks modern. Well, we'll go with that.
Don't fall into that trap.
No, they'll be here as well.
Yeah, I consider it to be character building.
Yeah, I think it's character building. But that's what I mean. It's, you know, I think it has a big impact on you, doesn't it, if you've grown up in that kind of environment.
Very much so. Absolutely. Well, yeah. Rowena, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. It's been wonderful to chat.
You're very welcome. Where can everybody keep up to date with your work and also try and track down Strange Waters and your forthcoming release?
Yeah, well, we've got, they can have a look at Strange Waters, which is on strangewaters.co.uk. And we're in post-production for The Day of the Sun Dog yet at the moment. So that's not quite out yet. But if you go to my website, it's rowenaamos.co.uk. You can follow me on there. And when it's out, we'll be posting information and stuff. So,
well, I wish you the very best of success with it. If it's half as good as Strange Waters, we'll be in for another treat.
Oh, that's very kind. Hopefully this should be good. We've got some brilliant shots. So I think we've got something special on this one. So we're looking forward to getting it finished.
Fabulous. Well, I wish you the very best of luck for the rest of the year, and hopefully we'll speak again in the future. And thank you again for joining me.
Thank you, Paul. Cheers.